This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and it's time for our weekly First Job segment, where we hear from famous and ordinary Americans about their very first work experience, what it was, what they learned, how it helped them get to where they are today, and oftentimes, funny stories from that very first job. And if you have a first job story, give us a call at 844-627-8255 and record your story there, or leave us your information and we can help you record it. Once again, that's 844-627-8255. Our first story is from a Chicago mom we once interviewed named Kathy Hamilton, a mom who fought and defeated the corrupt political machine at her local community college, the College of DuPage. Like we do with every guest, we also asked Kathy about her first job.
I actually enjoyed my first job. I know I was a clerk at a grocery store, and back then you used to actually have to type in the price of every single item. And I enjoyed that pace. It was fast, it was fun, it was quick. And I became very good at the 10 keypad. So that really helped me, because later on in life, I had to do a lot of inputting of numbers. And, you know, as a financial person and also as an accountant, that became in handy. So that came in handy, that skill, that dexterity was a good thing to develop. And also, you know, I'm a violinist, so I enjoyed working with my hands. It really worked well with being a violinist, being an accountant, and using that keypad. It taught me a lot.
And someone else who started out as a grocery store clerk, Yahoo CEO Marissa Meyer. Marissa once reflected on the experience, saying, quote, "I was a checkout clerk in the county market in Washaw, Wisconsin, a summer job when I first turned 16. Many of the cashiers had years of experience and were very committed to their jobs, so I saw firsthand the importance of a great work ethic. I learned that speed mattered. They measured our items per minute rate during each shift, and the only way to be eligible to work on Express Lane was to do 40 items per minute consistently over an 8-hour shift." Meyer has needed this work ethic from her first job. She now works 130 hours every single week. Well, now on to someone a little bit more famous than Kathy Hamilton. To lighten things up, let's hear from comedian and actor Chris Rock, who didn't like one of his first jobs at all, but it taught him what he definitely did not want to do with the rest of his life and gave him the inspiration to do what he does today, routines like this one.
This ain't really work, though. This is not really work. This is my career. It's not really a job. This is my career. You know, some people have jobs. Some people have careers. Some of y'all in the audience, some of y'all got jobs. Some of you have careers. Now, the people in the audience with careers need to learn to shut the fuck up when you're around people with jobs. They don't want to hear your career bullshit. Keep that to yourself, okay? Don't let your happiness make somebody sad, because that's what it does. Nah, man. But I used to work. I used to have a job. I used to work at Red Lobster. I used to work at Red Lobster and on Queens Boulevard. Oh, I served you. Good. I was a dishwasher. Used to scrape shrimp into garbage cans and then load up the dishwasher, man. And that was my real job. I never got a raise. I never got a promotion. They kept me in the back. They kept me back there because I had really fucked up teeth. And they didn't want people to think that shrimp fucked up your teeth. And that's what they do at restaurants. They put the ugliest people in the back. So if you don't like the people in the front, you don't want to see the people in the back. And that was my real job. I wasn't working my way through school. I wasn't working my way and telling jokes. That was my life. 1989, I was scraping shrimp, okay? And people go, "Chris, how'd you end up like that? How the fuck did that happen to you? Minimum wage job?" I'll tell you exactly how that happened to me. I dropped out of school in the 10th grade. Dropped out in the 10th grade, which is the dumbest thing you could ever fucking do. You know why? Because when you drop out in the 10th grade, really might as well have dropped out in the second grade. Why? Because you qualified for the exact same job. Matter of fact, the person that dropped out in the second grade is more qualified because they have 8 years of work experience. Yeah, man. Used to scrape those fucking shrimp, man. Used to kill me. But I'll tell you this right now. Now I have a career. I've been blessed with a career. So if you got a career, thank God. If you got a job, I hope you get a career one day. That's right. Because when you got a career, there ain't enough time in the day. There ain't enough time. When you got a career, you look at your watch, time just flies. Like, God, whoa, it's 5:35. I got to come in early tomorrow and work on my project. Because there ain't enough time when you got a career. When you got a job, there's too much time. That's right. You look at your watch like, ah, shit, 9:08. You don't even trust the time when you got a job. You be like, what time you got? 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 9:15? Whoever got the latest time is the right time. He got the right time. He got the right time. You ever play the time game with yourself at work? You ever play the time game where you go, I'm not going to look at my watch for 2 hours. That's right. I'm going to sit here and scrape these shrimp. Scrape, 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 scrape. Okay, hours pass. Maybe I should look and feel good. Nah, f*** that. I'm going to wait a whole nother hour. Scrape, 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 all right, 2 hours pass. Time to look and feel good about myself. And you look, 15 minutes.
And that's Chris Rock's take on work versus career. First Jobs, it's a segment we love to do every week. And this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. You can catch all of our work on everything at OurAmericanNetwork.org. That's OurAmericanNetwork.org. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Jesse, I love this bumping music.
Is this NPR?
It's for our little Goldberg piece here.
Ah, I love it. I thought you were trying to get me into a certain mood.
It'll match his
that.
Voice. You'll hear it here in a second.
Okay. Well, we're excited to bring you the first feature of a brand new series with our friend Steve Goldberg, the foremost expert on patriarchy, and he was a professor at City College for the longest time, and he's just one of those guys, when you hear him talk, he's the kind of guy you would have wanted to teach you any course. It wouldn't matter what course, you would have signed up for it in college. Remember that teacher? There was like two of them in the whole college. And then all the other ones that taught interesting stuff and made it boring. Remember those teachers? Exactly. I had teachers who could make Shakespeare boring. That ain't easy. But they did. Steve frequently joins us to talk about life, ranging from his boyhood hero Jackie Robinson to why there's not a sexless version of a cow and bull like there is with a horse. And now, it's Steve's daydreams. And before we begin and bring you his first daydream ever here on Our American Stories, Steve asked that we read this disclosure. Quote, "The following are all real daydreams that I have had over the past 7 decades. They are not written in the sense that one paces the floor at 5 a.m. trying to write a daydream about X, Y, or Z. These daydreams are simply arrived fully formed, popping into my head unexpectedly. That's the wonderful thing about daydreams. They require no talent at all." And with that, here is Steve Goldberg's first talentless daydream.
I'm on a TV talk show on the subject of Judaism in America. The panel members include the large, heavily tattooed skinhead leader of a vicious anti-Semitic gang. a priest, a minister, a rabbi, and me. They needed a sociologist. So the skinhead says, it's simple enough. We plan to clean up America by getting rid of the Jews and all their pollution by whatever means necessary. Me. Well, you're quite right in thinking that people have been trying to get rid of us by torture, by murder, by exile, by inquisition, by extermination, for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, ever since the Babylonians. But I've got one question for you. When was the last time you ran into a Babylonian?
And thank you as always. And that again is Steve Goldberg, sociologist, anthropologist, you name it. Just a study of the human mind and heart. We love him. We love his voice. And he's welcome to throw any more daydreams at us as long as he has them. And again, as he said, that's the wonderful thing about daydreams. They require no talent at all. So well said. And now it's time for This Day in History segment. And as always, our This Day in History segments are brought to us by the folks at Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, philosophy, all the things that matter in life. And if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale will get to you with their terrific and free online courses at hillsdale.edu. I suggest the great Constitution 101 class and also the C.S. Lewis class. And these are 10-part classes, anywhere from 40 to 50 minutes long. It's a real education. Circle your kids around it. You ain't going to get this in most high schools and colleges in this country. And on this day in history, a woman you may have heard of, but whose story you don't truly know, was born. And it's a story brought to us by Mike Rowe and his always colorful podcast, The Way I Heard It. Let's take a listen.
Frank was good with a gun. Really good. As the star of a vaudeville act called America's Own Rifle Team and Champion All-Around Shots. His preferred targets included spinning plates, clay pigeons, and various other inanimate objects. Phoebe was also good with a gun. As the person most responsible for keeping her family fed, her typical targets included rabbit, squirrel, and quail. Although she refused to shoot animals while they were standing still, Phoebe thought it was more sporting to pull the trigger when her targets were running or flying away. One day, Frank's traveling show came to Cincinnati. After wowing the crowds with a dazzling display of trick shots and extraordinary marksmanship, Frank proudly proclaimed to all assembled that he was the very best sharpshooter alive and bet $100 that no one in the county could prove him wrong. When the crowd pulled their resources and sent forth a champion, it was not the typical adversary to which Frank had become accustomed. His opponent was a little girl, maybe 5 feet tall, barely 100 pounds. She wore a skirt and knickerbockers and carried a rifle as big as she was. For a moment, Frank was overcome with guilt. These were simple country people, wagering their hard-earned money on a little girl 10 years his junior. What chance did she have? He was the best marksman in the country, undefeated, and according to his own prognostications, unbeatable. But a few moments later, Frank's guilt was replaced with wonder. In the best of 25 targets, Phoebe went 5 for 5 right out of the gate. Frank was surprised, but followed suit. Then she went 10 for 10. Frank was impressed, but still kept pace. Then 15 for 15. Who was this girl? Phoebe laughed and chatted while she shot, amusing the crowd like a seasoned performer. The two stayed deadlocked until the very last target. Frank missed. Phoebe didn't. And that was that. Frank had been bested for the first time ever by a little girl. Frank handled the humiliation the only way he could. He married the 16-year-old sharpshooter, which in 1875 was not nearly as icky as it sounds today, and took her on the road with him. Phoebe Moses became Phoebe Butler, and Frank's little shooting act got a whole lot more interesting. The first night, he called Phoebe out of the audience and told her to hold a single plate in each outstretched arm. Frank then shot the plates out of her hands to enthusiastic applause. But then, to the wonderment of the crowd, Frank handed his rifle to Phoebe and invited her to shoot the plates out of his hands, which she did. She also shot holes in playing cards that Frank threw into the air. She shot cigarettes out of Frank's mouth, sometimes with her back to him, using a mirror to aim over her shoulder. Among those impressed by their showmanship was the legendary Bill Cody. And before long, Frank and Phoebe were featured players in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. Now, if you've seen Irving Berlin's famous musical about Frank and Phoebe's incredible life, you know what happens next. Frank and Phoebe slowly become Phoebe and Frank. As his wife's popularity eclipses his own, Frank becomes insecure and resentful, and their relationship becomes strained. Not exactly a plot twist. The American West wasn't synonymous with gender equality. In the 19th century, American male was unaccustomed to second billing. So the tension that resulted from Phoebe's fame and Frank's insecurity was entirely plausible, except that's not what happened. The truth is, Frank didn't mope about his fading celebrity at all. In fact, he gladly assumed the position of Phoebe's onstage assistant and personal business manager. He may have been a brash and opportunistic showman, but he was also utterly smitten by his young bride, and by all accounts, stayed that way during their long and happy life together. Indeed, when his beloved Phoebe died, after 50 years of marriage, and millions mourned the most famous woman of the American West, Frank mourned in a way that was never addressed in the Broadway show or the film adaptation of their lives. Frank simply stopped eating and joined Phoebe in eternity 18 days later. Point is, many men have achieved greatness thanks to the women who have stood behind them. But once upon a time, back when the West was wild, one man was secure enough to step aside and let the spotlight fall on Phoebe Moses, a poor country girl who could outshoot the best of the best, and the girl we remember today as the one and only Annie Oakley. Anyway, that's the way I heard it.
And as always, these stories from Mike Rowe are terrific. His Facebook page, when you go on it, you can't get off it. It's just posts. It's filled with posts of all kinds of entertaining stuff. And I think it's the best you can ever see, Mike, actually, without the scripts, the hard scripts. I mean, obviously, this is a prepared script. But so much of the stuff, he puts his dog up in front of the camera and just starts talking. It's just riffs. And then he ends all that, pulls out one of these great stories, and that is a script, and it's well written and even more professionally delivered. Then again, Mike Rowe is an opera singer, so he knows a little something about not riffing when it comes to singing Figaro. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This day in history, Annie Oakley was born in 1860. And as always, our This Day in History is brought to us by Hillsdale College. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Recently, a friend of the show passed away. He was also a fellow radio broadcaster. His name was Jerry Doyle, host of The Jerry Doyle Show. Our producer, Jesse Edwards, was close to Jerry, and he brings us this week's final thoughts to pay tribute to our mutual friend.
I first met Jerry Doyle when I was working on the Laura Ingraham Show about 10 or 12 years ago. He was filling in for Laura and was really nervous because he had never hosted a three-hour-long nationally syndicated radio show before. It's not an easy task. But as soon as the show started, he sounded like an old broadcasting pro, and we became friends right off the bat. Things were always like that with JD. He could do just about anything he wanted to do in life, and did it often. Jerry wanted to become a pilot, so he did. He wanted to work on Wall Street, so he did. He wanted to become an actor, and he did. Jerry wanted to run for Congress, and he did, even though he lost. He wanted to be a radio talk show host, and he did. Jerry always did what he wanted to do, and he did it well. Most people probably know Jerry from his years on TV, where he played Michael Garibaldi, chief of security on the sci-fi TV series Babylon 5. A lot of other people know him from his years as the host of The Jerry Doyle Show on a lot of radio stations across the country. Here's Jerry from his speech at the 2011 Liberty Political Action Conference in Reno, Nevada, where he shared some of his philosophy on American politics.
The problem is the people who know, the people who have the ideas, the people who have the solutions are the ones that are blocked by the hard left and the hard right, which exploits the moderate middle, which is what most of America is to me. If you take a pendulum and you put it over the country and you swing that pendulum, it spends the least amount of time far right, spends the least amount of time far left, and the most amount of time going across the middle. We share more with each other than most would like to admit. We have more in common with each other than most would like to admit. Poverty isn't a black or white issue. Food stamps isn't a black or white issue. It's a people issue. We have people problems, but the problem is the people that we have supposedly solving those problems are the very same people that gave us the problems to begin with, the perpetuation of the status quo.
I always knew Jerry as a friend, first and foremost, one of my best. But Jerry had a lot of friends. We're going to hear from just a few of them today. Here's Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, one of Jerry's close friends, a war hero and one of the smartest guys you could ever meet. He was a whistleblower in Able Danger. It was a classified military planning effort led by the U.S. Special Operations Command that identified two of three Al-Qaeda cells active in the 9/11 attacks. Here's Colonel Schaefer with a story about how Jerry Doyle inspired him to come forward in that case.
I don't know where to begin with Jerry. Jerry was a dear friend and like a brother to me. A lot of people don't understand probably why we were close friends, and I think there's a number of reasons. First, Jerry was on air here in Washington during the 2005 time frame, and while I didn't know him, I listened to him every day. And it was during that period that the Able Danger issue, which I'm fairly well known for, became an event, an issue that was being investigated by Congress. So during that time frame, I'd say the summer of 2005 is the safe time frame to talk about. I would listen to Jerry on a daily basis driving home. I essentially was assigned to work on Capitol Hill during this period. I'd say June, July, August, and September of 2005. And Jerry was really going at accountability. He recognized then where the government was going, all the problems we were having. And not just government, I think just society and Wall Street and everything else. And what he was saying made a great deal of sense to me. And of course, I was in a position to do something about it. And so during that time frame, I listened to him every day. And he talked about accountability. He talked about doing the right thing, and naming names. So I think if for those who have not read my testimony on Able Danger, it's available online, I did exactly that. He motivated me to essentially do what was necessary, and because of that motivation, we became, I think, very, very dear friends. And really, the way we met, I called into his radio show right after Able Danger started. I heard him talking about me on the air, and I called in. I'd like to believe, based on the fact that, I didn't spend a lot of time together, the time we spent together, he was like a brother to me. It's very important to recognize people like Jerry. And I know I will always admire Jerry for his role as Garibaldi in Babylon 5. I was a big fan of Babylon 5 before. I'd like to believe, as much as he was well-loved by the fans of Babylon 5, he'll be remembered for bigger things he did, for his radio talk show, and for the leadership he showed trying to motivate others to do the right thing. And Jerry was like a brother to me, and his loss has been devastating. He was an amazing, amazing man, and I miss him already. And so that's all I can really say about Jerry at this point. Jerry, God bless you. Love you big. Amazing man. I hope you're out having shots with St. Peter as we speak. And I will see you, my friend, out past the rim someday.
I produced Jerry Doyle's radio show from around 2005 to 2011. When I eventually moved on from the show, the guy that took my place was Brad Silvers. Over the years, Brad became very close to Jerry, like we all did. and Brad was still Jerry's producer when he passed away. He's a fantastic producer with many years of experience under his belt and is also one of my very good friends. Here's Brad sharing some of his thoughts and feelings on the passing of our friend and mentor, Jerry Doyle.
I found out about the passing of Jerry Doyle from his neighbor and close friend. Fans of the show know him as famous neighbor Bill. Since that call, I've been numb, struggling to come to terms with the fact that I've lost one of my closest friends, a man that has become like an older brother to me over the past 5 years. I'd say like a father to me, but Jerry would hate that analogy. I'm 42. In 1997, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune wrote a hypothetical commencement speech titled Advice Like Youth, Probably Just Wasted on the Young. It became the lyrics for the 1999 Baz Luhrmann song Everybody's Free to Wear Sunscreen. There's a line in that piece that's been running over and over in my head since I got the sad news.
Don't worry about the future, or worry, but know that worrying is as effective as trying to solve an algebra equation by chewing bubblegum. The real troubles in your life are apt to be things that never crossed your worried mind, the kind that blindsides you at 4 p.m. on some idle Tuesday.
I got the news at 5 p.m. on an idle Wednesday. I was blindsided and knocked into an insensibility I have not yet recovered from. Every day for 5 years, including a lot of weekends, Jerry and I would talk on the phone. At first, it was all business, guests to book, audio to pull, topics to cover, and so on. But as the years went on, our phone calls became longer, and at least in the past couple of years, they were far more personal in nature. The business was still there, but we knew each other so well that we didn't really need to discuss it. For guests tonight, how about Gillespie on Gary Johnson, Ebeling's got a new piece on Epic Times, and let's do a roundtable with Ross, I'd ask. Make it happen. Did you watch Braindead last night? Jerry would answer, and the business was concluded. We talked about his mom, his mom's passing, his family, my family, our favorite TV shows, and by the way, Braindead on CBS was one of our favorites. Jerry called it the perfect kind of screwed up. Interwoven into all this personal chit-chat would be angles that Jerry could pull out and apply to his radio show topics for the day. I looked forward to my daily 7:30 a.m. call with Jerry. I still find myself seeing something and thinking, I've got to tell Jerry about this. And then it's like I got the news all over again. Jerry treated his support staff like equals, not subordinates. He valued our input and our opinions, and that's what made him such a pleasure to work with. It was impossible to work with Jerry Doyle on a daily basis and not like the man on a deeply personal level. Ask Jesse, Charles, Don, Patrice, Jose, or anyone else who worked on his show, and they'll tell you the same thing. Jerry's show was the one show on the network everybody wanted to work on, because most of the time, it wasn't really like a job. It was like a bunch of friends hanging out and talking about everything from presidential elections to the economy to Jerry's dislike for selecticized paper towels. He'd say, I have a lot of decisions to make every day, and what size paper towel I need shouldn't be one of them. Really, he hated selecticized paper towels. Over the years, I've worked with a lot of talk show hosts, and most of them needed to get in character before they went on the air. And sometimes the shift between the off-air and the on-air personality was great, and sometimes it was very subtle. But with Jerry, a professional actor, he never needed to get into character. The Jerry you heard on the air is exactly the Jerry you would hear off the air. Jerry never took himself too seriously either. Jerry was a great radio host, entrepreneur, and employer. But he was an even better friend. And at the end of the day, that's how I'll remember him. My friend, Jerry Doyle.
More final thoughts on Our American Stories. This is Our American Stories, and we're continuing our final thought segment, celebrating and commemorating the life of Jerry Doyle. I was a friend of his, and Jesse was an even closer friend. We both worked with Jerry, and we've learned he was an actor, he was a trader. He worked for Michael Milken at Milken's desk at Drexel Lambert. He was a pilot and was respected by hardcore pilots. And then he decided to do a talk show, and he was an interesting guy. He didn't want to toe the line for the right. He didn't want to toe the line for the left. And so his show, well, it could have been a lot bigger if he decided to do either of those things, but he decided not to. And he walked a very different path. And it was a big show, but that wasn't what he cared about, because it could have been a much, much bigger show. if he decided to cut some corners and tie some knots together. But Jerry, that wasn't his style. And so now we go back to Jesse, who knew Jerry so well, and to Rick Alberton, one of Jerry's best friends. Take it away.
Over the years of getting to know Jerry Doyle, I had the opportunity to get to know some of his friends. But there's one guy in particular that Jerry seemed to talk about the most, his buddy Rick Alberton. I remember one time when I was having a really hard time and Jerry and I were talking like we always did. Jerry actually patched Rick in on the phone call so they could tag team me with some advice on how to get through my personal struggle. I know just how much Jerry loved Rick, and it's an honor to have him here to share with us some of his thoughts and memories of our beloved friend, Jerry Doyle.
Jerry Doyle. This guy was my friend for 20 years. Man, it's a long time. I still remember the night we met, though. It was a hotel bar in Maryland. Shocker, right? In a bar. There was a sci-fi convention in the hotel, and I remember I was sitting at the bar drinking a bourbon, and this tall guy with this really, you know, distinctive, deep voice sits down next to me and strikes up a conversation. Well, I call it that. He actually started talking trash about my bourbon. I think I was drinking Knob Creek or something, and he starts telling me about Maker's Mark, and I got to try it. And so I try it, and what do you know? Damn if he wasn't right. It's pretty good stuff. So we talk cigars and women, and before long we're out of dinner eating steaks and swapping war stories. And this guy had some serious stories. By the end of the night, we closed down their hotel restaurant, and he suggested we take the party out, and we end up in a gentleman's club, and, hell, we stay there until, like, before dawn. And, you know, the details, I think, I'll take to my grave, but that was my first night out with Jerry, and there would be literally thousands more over the years. He was a fun, outgoing guy who just loved to go out and enjoy life. I hear people talking about living life to the fullest, and it always sounds inane coming from them, but this guy did that, and like in spades. He used to say, here's to the night we'll never remember, but people will never forget. Jerry was the most genuine and loyal person I've ever known. And smart. Man, he was a smart guy. Always a step ahead of everyone in the room. Like to say, you know, smartest guy in the room, that was him. And his table was always, you know, the cool kid's table. The best seat in the house. Jerry saw the humor in everything. Politics, religion, business. His dysfunctional Irish Catholic family. Three marriages and his crazy-ass love life. It was how he survived, I think. Laughter was medicine, but it was also kind of infectious. And he always let you in on the joke, you know? I mean, even if you, like, were the joke. Nobody was safe either. He was, in his own words, an equal opportunity offender. He used to talk about the Catholic Church, you know. He said, you know, you go into confession and you start off with saying, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. He said, but after that big scandal they went through and all that stuff, he said he'd sit down and say, you go first. And he was a lot more than just a funny guy, though, you know. I mean, he was a reinventor, mostly of himself. I mean, over the past 40 years, he became a pilot, a stockbroker, an actor, a politician, an author, a talk radio show host, and ultimately a web-based entrepreneur. You know, most of us have one career. This guy had seven. And pretty much he kicked ass at all of them. In 1980, he was working for Falcon Jet, and he crashes this party at the Playboy Club in Jersey. And while he's there, he talks himself into a stockbroker job in California. Really? I mean, he drives out there, all the way out west, broke as a joke. He's sleeping on the floor for 6 months, cold calling, and before you know it, he's loaded, successful, and kicking ass as a stockbroker. And he did it for like more than a decade. But then it was like he planted his flag and then was, you know, ready to move on. He hung up a Series 7 license, and then he went to Hollywood to become an actor. And he didn't go to Hollywood to, like, try to become an actor or to work on being an actor. He went out there to become an actor, and he did it. He used to call L.A. the high cost of living low. Kind of a joke, you know, but he was a natural out there. He smooth-talked and BS'd his way into guest spots and day player roles in soap operas. I mean, there were people working for years out there that couldn't do what he did. And then all of a sudden, he hits it big, he He lands a starring role in a television series, his own show. For the next 5 years, he gets to play Station Security Chief Garibaldi on Babylon 5, to the delight of millions of sci-fi fans around the world. And I'm talking about the whole world. When he passed away, if you look at Facebook for that week, messages were pouring in from his fans, I mean, from around the globe, remembering him and expressing shared grief at his loss. I mean, it touched me, and they weren't even talking about me. I loved the guy, you know, and I remember we were traveling one time, coming back from a sci-fi show in Europe one time, and, you know, against the advice of his lawyer, namely me, he had this carry-on bag full of small bills from signing autographs at his table. And so we're waiting in line, and I'm telling him that he's an idiot, you know, he's going to get us popped by customs and all, and what do you know, he scanned his bag, and boom, we're detained. Our bags have been checked already, though. The stuff that was going on the plane, and they're probably on the plane. And I'm starting to freak out, and then one of these big, burly German airport security guys takes us both by the arm and starts dragging us into this little room, and I'm thinking, oh, hell, here it comes. So then we get in there, and I'm expecting the cuffs to come out, and this guy starts laughing. He's, like, saying in broken English, you know, Garibaldi doesn't wait in my line. And so then he takes us, and he grabs us, and he takes us through the crew door, out onto the tarmac, and straight to our plane. It was pretty sweet. Jerry always told these stories better than I could. And, you know, there's a million of them. We had adventures all the time. It was, you know, it was just great. And it's a really, really strange feeling to know that now there's nobody else to tell the stories. I mean, I guess they're not even stories anymore. They're just memories. I was hanging out with this other longtime friend of mine tonight, and he said something that really resonated with me. He said that, you know, it's okay to not be okay with Jerry's death. And he's right, you know. I'm not okay with it. The world, my world, your world, is a smaller place without JD in it. It's a little darker and a whole lot less fun. I'm the oldest of my parents' kids, and I never had an older brother growing up, but for pretty much my entire adult life, Jerry's been my older brother. He was there for me when I got married, when I went back to business school, and he was one of my biggest supporters when I started law school. When I became a prosecuting attorney, he used to brag to everybody about my unbeaten trial record. I was undefeated. And then I switched sides, and he started cheering, you know, whenever I was able to slay the dragon. I've always hated saying goodbye. And so to my brother Jerry, I think I'll just say, I'm going to go watch the sunrise. And until I see you again, brother, save me a seat at that cool kid's table.
We've heard from Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer about how Jerry inspired him to take a stand. We heard from Brad Silvers, Jerry's last producer, about how Jerry was his friend, mentor, and boss. And we heard from perhaps his closest friend, Rick Alberton, about Jerry's loyalty, intelligence, and integrity. In closing, I'd like to share just a little bit about how Jerry touched my life. Jerry was the guy who could get any girl in the room but would rather spend time drinking with the guys, trading stories about good times. He'd give you the shirt off his back if you wanted it, and get you to laugh before your day was over. A cynical optimist who was always looking for the ironic twist in life that made everything easier to understand. He always treated me like a son, a brother, and a friend, no matter what I was going through. He always took the time to listen to what I had to say, no matter how off target I might have been. I'll always remember the times when Jerry would visit and we'd close down the bar together, or when he came to my wedding and caught my wife's garter. He wore it on his head for about 10 minutes after that just to get some laughs. We would talk for hours on end about life, love, memories, dirty jokes. We would talk about everything, sometimes until the wee hours of the morning. He was always there, always ready to listen, always able to give some solid advice, always able to help people in any way he could. It was impossible not to be Jerry's friend, because with Jerry, business was always personal, as it should be. I would not have a career today if it wasn't for his patience, his guidance, direction, and above all else, his sense of humor. Jerry taught me how to grow up without losing touch with my inner child. He showed me how to roll with the punches and how to do it with a smile. He opened my eyes to truths that could only be shared by a master of logic and compassion. I've lost a brother, a friend, a mentor, and a confidant. I wish I had the chance to say goodbye, but I know that when we meet again, it'll be like we never missed a beat. like it always was. Via con Dios, JD. Next round is on me. Rest in peace, brother.
Final thoughts. The life of Jerry Doyle, the friend of the show, and obviously and clearly a friend of Jesse's and mine. This is Our American Stories.
I want to thank everybody who's worked on this record, all the musicians and all the PR folks and all the folks at the label. Everybody's worked so hard, and I want to thank everybody here for treating this record so kindly.
And that was Chris Stapleton. He just ripped it up at the CMA Awards, and I think the country's been waiting for an authentic artist like this, and Adele and the types of folks who are coming up now, just great musicians, whatever you think about categories of music. This is just music, man. It's just good. And we love music here at Our American Stories. And so for this half hour, we're going to talk about Chris Stapleton. His life a little bit, but in the end, his music. And we know he grew up in Kentucky, born in Lexington, spent his time in a small town called Staffordsville. And he graduated from Johnson Central High. We're going to learn a little bit later. He's a pretty smart guy. He ended up going to Vanderbilt University and studying engineering, of all things. And luckily for all of us, he dropped out. And that doesn't mean the world doesn't need engineers. But what the world really needed was a Chris Stapleton record. I know I can't drive more than an hour right now without listening to it. He channels, I think, what, Dwayne Allman and Bob Seger and B.B. King. It's what all I can think of. He has the lyricism of Seger. And lyrics of Seger's are just some of the best. And, man, his singing, you just hear Dwayne. I just hear it coming through. And that's why he sounds so familiar to people, because he sort of is familiar. And the second you hear him, you go, I've heard this guy before. And even though you hadn't, you had. And there was a piece done on CBS Sunday Morning, and we learned a little bit about Stapleton. And here he is talking about all the songs he's written for other people because he's been around a long time.
I'm new to a lot of people, and that's true. I'm not new to a lot of people in Nashville. They're like, man, I've known that guy for years. He's been bugging everybody.
Anytime somebody sings one of your songs, it's cool.
Very cool. Extremely cool. Like, I think it's the highest compliment.
Any idea how many of your songs other people have cut over the years?
Probably pushing 200, something like that. I don't know.
It's a lot of songs.
It's a lot of songs, yeah. So, but I've written a lot of songs too. Like, I don't know, I think close to 1,000 or more.
1,000 songs. So the reason you don't hear about this guy in a clinic somewhere is because he's been a journeyman pro for so long that now that he's getting all this success, he's just not going to abuse it. Chris talks about his quick success after moving to Nashville and the jobs he did before that.
I didn't know they would pay you money to sit in a room and write songs for other people. I always thought that George Strait was singing a song, he made it up, and that was the end of it, you know. But the instant I found that out, that could be a job, I was like, well, that's the job for me. I got to figure out how to do that. You know, I moved to Nashville, and 4 days later I had a publishing deal, so which is not, that is not anybody's story, but that's mine. So
it's a good story to have.
It's a good story. I did all of my starving artist things not in Nashville.
So. Like?
Have you ever had somebody stick a pizza coupon on your windshield in a parking lot? I did that. I sold cars. I was a car salesman.
Were you really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. And he learned to write out of town. By the way, some of the actors I knew who came to New York who had been at the Guthrie Theater or the Arena stage and really, you know, sort of gotten their professional chops out of town were able to come in their late 20s with real chops, with a real knowledge of what being a working actor is. The people who came at 19 out of college, oh my goodness, pity them. I mean, they just weren't ready. They were going to get eaten up. Chris says he did what he wanted on this last album because he had had one before. And the way it was produced, the way it was put together, it just didn't do that well. And so on this record, The Traveler, he recorded it and did it his way.
Yeah, I thought this might be the last record I ever got to make. So I'm just like, I'm just going to do whatever I want to.
I'm just a traveler on this earth, shining my heart behind the pocket of my shirt.
And what you're hearing back there is this remarkable harmony. And I think that Morgan Stapleton may be as good, and I say this with no reluctance whatsoever, may be as good a background vocalist as Emmylou Harris. And I think she has a lot of the same properties and the same concentration and focus that Emmylou has whenever she sings with anybody. And so we hear from his wife, his bride, his love, Morgan Stapleton herself, who says she is still very much smitten with Chris. And by the way, you can see it when they're on the stage. And that she can't believe it took so long for him to become famous.
Back in the day when you were smitten with him, waiting for him to notice you.
For the record, I am still very smitten.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. But did you imagine a day when so many people would also be smitten with him?
Yeah, I can't believe it took so long.
You always thought this day would come?
Yeah, always.
She has an unwavering belief in me that I don't even have, so it really helps. She has enough belief for both of us.
And boy, that really helps no matter who you are to have that kind of partner who believes in you more than you do. And as an artist, oh my goodness, you can't survive without that. Because sooner or later, people won't like Chris Stapleton. And he will become yesterday's music until he becomes discovered again. Look, we did that hour on Johnny Cash. Star, not a star, star again, not a star, star again. You need some love in your life to be able to handle that. I want to go out right now with a cover that the Stapletons did together at the Grand Ole Opry. And it just shows you the power of their singing and how two becomes, well, just something so special. It's Bob McDill's Amanda. Take a listen as we go out.
I've held it all in. God knows I've tried. It's an awful way. Country boy's life. Look in the mirror in total surprise. Have the hair on my shoulders and the age in my eyes. Amanda, light of my life. Fate should have made you a gentleman's wife. Amanda.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and you're listening to Chris Stapleton and his wife covering Folsom Prison. And for the rest of this segment, you're just going to be hearing from Chris Stapleton as he should be heard, singing and playing. And so let's start cutting through some of the music, but before we do, two more insights into the man. Here's an interview we stumbled upon where Chris reluctantly talks about his life in high school, how uncool he was, and a little tidbit you just wouldn't have imagined from a guy who's this talented with an axe and songwriting.
You went home, played some hometown shows. You did get to go home again. They say you can't go home again, but you made it happen. Was that weird or cool?
Both. It's weird and cool, you know, because there's guys you went to high school with or anything, and I don't know. It's just they know you when you weren't cool. And you're still not, but everybody else thinks you might be, you know. So.
Okay, so you brought it up. What was the most uncool thing about you in high school?
Everything. Everything about me was uncool in high school, but that's okay.
I can't believe that. I can't believe that at all. Were you marching band? What was your gig?
I played sports, and I got good grades. I was pretty straight-laced back then.
Okay. All right. Yeah, because you're valedictorian, right?
Yes. Guilty.
Smart and talented. We love that.
Yeah. Uncool. How many of us felt uncool in high school? Raise your hands, please. That's just about everybody. And so let's take a listen to some of the songs he's written for others. My sister's a songwriter, so she's been sending me Chris Stapleton songs for a long time and saying, I don't want to write anymore. That's how good he is. And everybody from Adele to Tim McGraw, I mean, you can go on and on. What a different type of singer Adele is than Tim McGraw. So what writing chops. But this is him at an ASCAP expo, and ASCAP is a collection of royalties agency that basically makes money for songwriters and collects money from bars and record labels and everybody else so that the writer can get rewarded. And they have expos from time to time where writers perform for other writers. And it's just wonderful. I mean, I think it's sustenance for writers, these expos. And they just honor each other. Here's Chris Stapleton singing Whiskey and You.
But I do have some drinking songs.
Now we're talking.
And this is one that was on a Tim McGraw record. There's a bottle on a dresser by your ring, and it's empty. So right now I don't feel a thing, and I'll be hurting when I wake up on the floor, but I'll be over it by noon. That's the difference between whiskey and you. Come tomorrow, I can walk in any store. It ain't a problem. They'll always sell me more. But your forgiveness, well, that's something I can't buy. There ain't a thing that I can do. That's the difference between whiskey and you. One's a devil, one keeps driving me insane. At times I wonder if they ain't both the same, but one's a liar, it helps to hide me from my pain, and one's a long gone bitter truth. That's the difference between whiskey and you.
Wow. Straight to the heart. What a storyteller in the end. Let's take a listen to another. This Adele recorded. If It Hadn't Been for Love. This too at a Sundance ASCAP Music Showcase.
This is a song I wrote, many of you, about the 21 album, the Adele album, over in Europe, which I know a lot of you did. This was on.
Never would have hitchhiked to Birmingham if it hadn't been for love. Never would have caught the train in Louisiana if it hadn't been for love. never would have run through the blinding rain without $1 to my name. Never would have seen the trouble that I'm in if it hadn't been for love. Would have been gone like a wayward wind if it hadn't been for love. Nobody knows it better than me. I wouldn't be wishing I was free if it hadn't been, if it hadn't been for love.
And then in 2013, Stapleton took a run at his own record. And, well, I don't think he was completely happy with the way the record was put together, particularly the way it was recorded. But boy, the songwriting was there. And I think you'll get a lot of people picking this record up. My favorite from this record, and my wife introduced me to this one. What Are You Listening To?
I put that record on. Girl, you know what song. And I let it play again and again. You're in every line. Takes me back in time. Yeah, tonight I'm wondering, what are you listening to? Is it a cover band in some college town bar where it's 9 hours and their guitars? Or is it something to get you through? Just a sad song playing on the radio station. Tears still falling, heart still breaking, cause you're hanging on. Or is it a love song about someone new? What are you listening to?
And I'll never forget, she wrote me, she goes, listen to that line. Is it a cover band in some college bar where it's na-na-nas and air guitars? And I just went, she went, damn it, I want to write that. It's not fair. And now we get to The Traveler, which I think is just a masterwork. And let's take a listen to Tennessee Whiskey. This is Lee Habib, the work of Chris Stapleton. Google him and Justin Timberlake doing this. A little bit of Nashville, a little bit of Memphis. The horns come in, a little bit of Stax, too. More from Chris Stapleton as we go out.
Found the bottom of the bottle's always dry. But when you...
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, where we love to tell stories about everything, but particularly just about American life. And one of the cornerstones of American life is work. And it's also entrepreneurship and free enterprise and just living your dream by starting a business. And the intersection of these two things, because when a person starts a business, ultimately to grow it, they've got to hire workers. And so we wanted to talk to a few people about this, and we're talking to ordinary Americans all across this country, ordinary workers, and just as important, perhaps more important, and not that the workers aren't important, but if we don't have people creating jobs, there's no place for people to work. And so we want to talk to those people who have the daring and courage to start new businesses and run them, and talk to them about what's going on in their lives too. And joining us for this series is Jane Johnson and Zach Model. And welcome both of you to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Now, Jane, let's start with the worker first, and let's learn a little bit about you, Jane. Because when I hear the name Jane, I don't think machinist, generally. Talk to me about your life and what led you to become this thing called a machinist.
Okay. Well, I was born on the west side of Chicago. I lived and was raised by my grandmother. Unfortunately, my mom, she had schizophrenia, so she wasn't able to care for me as well. So I lived with her until I was 13. And once I became 13, my grandmother, she became ill with liver cancer. And after she passed away, I moved to my great aunt's, which is my grandmother's sister's house, also on the west side of Chicago. And from there, I've grown. I've graduated from high school. I went to college for a couple of years, came back because my aunt was a little sick and she needed help. And from there, I was at home, and I realized, hey, I have to contribute. I have to do something. I have to contribute to society somehow. So I had a counselor, and she gave me a little bit of information about TMA, which is a program that teamed up with this church called Bethel New Life, technology manufacturing aligned with TMA, and I attended classes there. I got really excited because I always had a love for just anything I can get my hands on, being technical, anything that I can basically rip apart and find out how it works. So that program was perfect for me. I went to school for a couple of weeks and graduated. And yeah, after graduation, Zach reached out to me, and from there, that's all that.
The rest is history.
Yep.
And Jane, it's interesting because when you start talking about taking stuff apart and putting it back together, I got a little girl who loves the same thing, and I can try and put a little bow on her head and put a dress. She ain't having any of it. She wants to learn how to take apart a gun. She wants to learn how to take apart anything that moves. And I just don't want to get in the way. Now, here's what's interesting. You're now working in a place doing something you love. You don't have a college degree. This is, by the way, something we talk over and over with people about. College just isn't right for everybody. We're not here to slam colleges. We have a great sponsor that's a college. But for you, it just didn't make sense. Talk a little bit about that and how this training changed your life.
Definitely, the training has changed my life in so many ways. Number one, I have gotten a leg up in society thanks to this training. So without having a degree, some people might feel that they won't be able to contribute to society or do anything for themselves, and they'll just be falling by the wayside. But no, training, it actually gave me a little bit of knowledge and a little bit more something to work with than the average Joe. And, yeah, manufacturing, the whole industry has just brightened my eyes and made me believe that there is still a way for me as a regular, a little bit more than a regular Joe, I would say.
Yeah, I would say. And, you know, you right now, you're a single young woman living in what we can charitably call a pretty tough neighborhood, the west side of Chicago. Tell us about what it's like there. And do you sometimes wonder or wish you could talk to some of your friends there and share with them your experience? Do you? And are they inclined to maybe follow you? Have you led any people to follow you in your steps, Jane?
Well, I have told a couple of people about the program. And, yeah, on the west side of Chicago, there is crime everywhere you go. There's constant drug dealing, there's gang banging, there's all of that, and I kind of stayed by the wayside with that. I didn't want any business with that, because if I would, anything that I would do would bring any harm to my family, that would just completely crush me, because obviously family is all I have, and I would want to do as much as I can to protect it and contribute to it. So I stayed out of the streets. I didn't do anything that would, my aunt would call stupid. And, I've let a couple of people know in my neighborhood about it, but unfortunately, the way that they think, they don't think that, they don't have enough confidence in themselves, or they might turn their nose a certain way at what I do. But, hey, at least I let them know.
Yep, you let them know, and life's filled with choices in the end. And, you know, the tragedy of so many of these neighborhoods is simply an utter lack of family guidance. And actually, when and where it can, the church just isn't in enough of these folks' lives, too. And let's face it, this faith-based nonprofit really had a lot to do with this life change.
Definitely, yeah.
And Jane, you, and by the way, we're going to be getting to Zach Model in just a minute, but we always love to talk where we think stories should start. And in my mind, where this started was, my goodness, the work of Zach, the entrepreneur, allowed Jane to have a job. And so we want to start with Jane, because my goodness, this job doesn't exist, and Jane may not have a way out of the unsafe and violent neighborhood that she currently lives in. And Jane, where are you dreaming of moving to?
Well, initially it's Oak Park. That's the dream. It seems very cultured, safe, and as well as just a pretty darn trendy neighborhood, I would say.
Well, good. And yeah, you want what all people want in the end, and that's to have a safe and decent place to raise mm-hmm. your family. And tell me, if you would, about your boss. He reached out to you. What has he meant in your life, and what has this job meant to your life, Jane?
Well, initially, Zach, he actually came to me the day of my graduation and offered me a job. So from that day, it was actually he's been a shocker of mine. He's been a great shock to me, because I would have never imagined someone of his stature would come up to me and initially offer me a job without me even knowing him, or him knowing me as well. So he's been constantly dropping all of these blessings my way, and it was, I mean, he's a great guy, very friendly, smile that can light up a room. He's amazing.
And you know, he did something that we don't do often enough, and that's place our belief in people. We're doing a story about Brett Favre's retirement speech. And in that retirement speech, Jane, what was interesting is this guy from Little Kiln, Mississippi, a poor rural town in a place where nobody goes anywhere. And constantly, Brett Favre told the story of how total strangers and people he barely knew believed in him more than he believed in himself, and that he couldn't have gotten where he got. And that's got to mean a lot to you, to have a total stranger come up to you on your graduation day and say, you know what, I like you, kid. Come work for me.
Yep, exactly.
Well, good for you, Jane. Look, when we come back, it's going to be time to talk to Zach. And we're going to be talking to Zach Model and his business. And that's Atlas Tool and Die Works. And that's in Chicago, Illinois. And he employs Jane, and he employs some other folks there, too. We're going to learn all about Zach's life and what he's up against in Chicago as an entrepreneur trying to build, grow, and in the end, expand his business like all good entrepreneurs. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages. We'll be right back. is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Work, free enterprise, and even a little bit of faith in this segment. The intersection of all three, the collision, and what and how business impacts work, and how work impacts a life, a human life. And we just talked to Jane Johnson, and what a great story. And we heard a lot about Zach already, Zach Model, from Jane. And my goodness, what a testimonial, Zach. Before you even come on, everybody listening to this already loves you. And that's not easy. Zach Model, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be here, Lee. I've got a lot to live up to, and hopefully I'll do it. Thank you.
Yeah, no pressure. You know, Zach, you're the fourth generation owner of Atlas Tool and Die Works. Tell us about your family, how this all started, and tell us about your business now.
Yeah, so I'm the fourth generation family business here at Atlas Tool. My great-grandfather started it in 1918 in downtown Chicago. And, you know, initially we built dies and fixtures for the burgeoning industry as the Industrial Revolution was kind of happening in the early 1900s. And we made it through two world wars and a couple other wars. And over the years we kept, I think the key to our success at our business was we kept pivoting and transitioning to where the opportunity was. And again, in the beginning we were just tools and dies and fixtures. And in the 50s we added stamping in response to customer demand. And then in the 70s, EDM technology. And every decade, we layered on another set of technology. We put some more tools on our belt, so to speak. And what we really sell is manufacturing services. So whatever custom parts and pieces our customers need, that's what we need to have the services and the technology to supply. So, you know, we've been fortunate for almost 100 years to keep pivoting here and fortunate to get to work together as a family. I work with my father. My two sisters are in the business and very blessed to have that opportunity. And I'm blessed to have such wonderful employees like Jane and my other team members. You know, the average tenure at my company, while we're growing and expanding, still the average tenure is over 20 years.
Most, oh my goodness,
people that come here, they stay here and they work here, they have a career for a lifetime. And I so value those people, because that's really what's made us successful over the years.
Of course. And you know that you keep those people is testimony to management, because good management retains people. And to retain people in an ever-changing environment is no duck walk, Zach. How do you do that? Because change is tough. And sometimes people just want to resist change, but it sounds like your team understands that you either change together or you die together.
Well, that is tough, and we've had a few close calls over the years. You know, my father and I recently bought out his cousins 2 years ago, and I think those were two people, nice people, but they had a different opportunity, a different belief in change, and change is hard. So if you're not willing to embrace it and to modernize and to keep going where the opportunity is, you will miss the boat here. And I think, you know, in terms of keeping people, you know, we treat people fairly, treat people well, treat them like we would like to be treated. And I like to say, you know, my team and James, maybe you can attest to this, you know, I work as hard as I expect my team to work. You know, I'm not the owner that goes out golfing all day and tells my people to go and take care of their work. No, I'm here working with them. And on Saturday, I'm here too. And I'm here late. And I come in early. So I try to set the example for my team, and I expect the same from them. I expect the best from them, and I expect to give the best because we want to win together. It's a team. It really is a team effort. So, you know, everybody from the people sweeping the floor to the people taking the orders and managing the customer, we are all important. Nothing functions without each one of those jobs getting done. So you know, I believe in that, and we've tried to reward people as we could when we're making money, when we're profitable, when we're doing well. We've certainly shared the rewards with the team over the years, and I think that's why people come and stay. But now, you know, it is time to our business is changing again, and it is time to attract that next generation of workers, and Jane is a great example of hopefully what will be the next generation of the workforce will be here for another 20, 30, 40 years.
Well, that's fantastic. And, you know, a book that we had interviewed the author of, a book called Team of Teams. We interviewed Stanley McChrystal, and we took a couple of calls. And what was interesting is a couple of guys who trained under him said, you know, you were the best boss a guy could ever have. You were up with us, you trained with us, and you went to sleep when we went to sleep. And I think that is always a sign of leadership, that you don't do anything. You would not do anything you didn't ask your own people to do. And that's just a sign of great leadership. Zach, you're in Chicago. How many employees do you have in your company?
So we've been growing, but as of the last count that I heard at Atlas, we're approaching 74 or 75 employees. We have, I think, about five temps right now, so in total about 80 here. We have two other related businesses where we employ some more people. So in total, we're getting close to 90 employees between all the businesses here in Chicago.
And that's a lot of lives to be responsible for, Zach. And I always like to put people in the shoes of other people, because empathy is really important. And obviously you care about your workers, but in the end, you have to, in the end, pay for, you're responsible for the payroll. You're responsible for the health care. This is, I don't want to call it a burden, but it's a heck of a responsibility, isn't it, Zach?
It is, and this is something, you know, my dad has always made me keenly aware of since I was a little kid, about that responsibility of owning a business and employing people. And he says it's not just our family that we're worried about, it's the other 90 families. And it's not just the 90 people who work for us, it is their 3, 4, 5 people in their families. He says we are responsible for several hundred people here with these jobs, not just ourselves. My dad has always made that clear to me, and how important that is to empathize and understand and take care of these people, and they will take care of us. And so, yeah, it is a burden. In Chicago, it's really not easy. You know, we have in Illinois one of the highest workers' compensation costs in the nation, and it's unfortunate because in Illinois it seems like the workers' compensation system, it's certainly the two parties it was set up to protect, the employer and the employee, I think are both losers in the system in Illinois. I think there are other parties, some of them being doctors, some of them being lawyers, and maybe perhaps a little bit the insurance companies, who benefit far more than the two primary parties of the system was set up to protect, and we bear a very high cost because of that in Illinois, an unusually high cost. In Chicago, and I'm in Cook County, we enjoy some of the highest property taxes on business in the nation. You know, our property tax bill is approaching, you know, we've expanded and we bought out the building next door 2 years ago as part of this expansion plan that we're under. And our property tax bill is approaching $200,000 a year for our buildings, which I'm fine to pay taxes and pay a fair share, but it just seems that the burden here is growing disproportionately to other areas. For example, if I was in Indiana, my workers' compensation would be about a third, and my property taxes could be significantly less, maybe half or if not more, lower from where I'm at. So, you know, it is hard to stay here, but we have a lot of people that walk to work. We have people in the community that get here. It's convenient for them. So moving isn't just about me and the bottom line. You know, it's about the other people that are here, that come to work here, and how it would affect them. So, you know, as long as I can afford to and as long as business will support it, we want to stay here. But that is, every year I kind of look at it and scratch my head and say, you know, it's six figures. It's a couple more jobs. It's another machine, you know. So hopefully we can keep working in Illinois and educate these policymakers to make some better choices.
You bet. And by the way, you said something really important there, Zach. You said six figures, that's another job and another machine. And you talk like every guy I know who runs a small business. You didn't say six figures, I'm putting that in my pocket and I'm up in my golf membership. That's not what you said to me. You said more workers, better machines. You want to grow your business. I don't know a guy who starts a business or a gal who that's not what they want to do. And it sounds like the state of Chicago and Cook County in particular is tough. I want to read you something that the Technology and Manufacturing Association president, Steve Rauschenberger, told one of our staff. He said, Mayor Daley set up a higher tax rate on commercial and industrial businesses in Cook County because he thought it would be more difficult for them to move than the residents. That is about as cynical a thing as I could imagine a political figure doing. Do you think that's true, or do you think this is just the cost of doing business in a city that has a lot of corruption in it?
Well, so Mayor Daley, if we like him or not, he was smart. And I think his statement has some truth to it, that it is very hard for businesses to leave. Look at what I said. But do I think it's right? Absolutely not. I hate the way businesses and business owners get demonized by government and media and policymakers sometimes, saying that, you know, we're the fat cats, that $100,000 is another $100,000 in my pocket. I'm the last guy in line to get money here. You know, my first goal as we're profitable is to give more to my employees. I'll get it in the end. I know it'll come from me if everybody else is successful. But I'd rather, like you said, reinvest in another machine, reinvest in another job, and build it bigger. That's just how I am. But, you know, we have this tendency in public debate right now to villainize business owners as fat cats and that we're just lining our pockets, but we forget the food chain here. If we don't have people like me willing to take the risk and put the money in and create the jobs, we don't have an economy. And we can't villainize people. And you know, when it is time to take the money out and the owner is time to make a profit, they should, because they put the risk in and they worked the hours and they made the effort to create the jobs. So typically the owner isn't first in line, but when it is their time, I'm in favor of owners making some money, and I'm in favor of these good jobs and stuff. So I wish that policymakers would kind of respect that food chain a little bit more. I'm a believer that if you let business succeed, you will get your tax revenue in the end, but you sometimes you have to give a little first in order to get at the end.
You bet. And Zach, who do they have left to tax if you move to Indiana? And then,
well, that's the
good
thing.
Luck.
The burden is getting bigger and bigger on a smaller pool.
Yep, no doubt about it. Zach, thanks so much for joining us. And Jane, my goodness, what a great story. And we want to stay in touch with you, Jane, and you too, Zach. We'd love to come back in 6 months. Just a regular update. What's going on in your lives? What hurdles you're facing in your life? And Zach, in particular, how your own government is getting in the way of you growing your own business. This is Lee Habib, Jane Johnson, Zach Model, our American Dreamer series, brought to us, as always, by Job Creators Network. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories.